So thank you very much, and so let me apologize for all this. So it was my first time I tried to use a computer, or even I think transparencies, my life. So far it hasn't been very successful. So I will speak on the shifted convolution problems. So this is something rather technical. So we take a primitive modular form of some level and Nebentipus, but for the moment we assume these are fixed. And so the shifted convolution problem consists in estimating this kind of sums, which is a sums of over a product of eigenvalues when the variables are linked by a linear relation. And so the variable vary over in a box, say, of size m times n. And in general, for us, we can assume that m equals n. And so what is important here is that is the variable h, which is to be non-zero. So L1 and L2 are integers, but we can take them to be very small power of the main variable. So for the purpose of this talk, we can consider they are equal to 1, essentially. So the trivial bound for this kind of shifted convolution sum is the max of M and N, essentially. And the shifted convolution problem addresses the question of non-trivial estimates for such sum, that is, to isolate a main term, which depends on H, plus an error term, which is m to the 1 minus delta for small but positive delta. So this problem, when H equals 0, becomes essentially a partial sum of Rankine-Selberg type, and it can be evaluated easily by the analytic property of Rankine-Selberg convolutions. So we are interested in the case when H is not equal to zero, and in this case, so maybe the first time this kind of problem was considered, it was by Ingham, when G is the standard derivative, is the derivative of the standard Eisenstein series, so Fourier coefficients are the divisor function. So in this case, this instance of the shifted convolution problem is the shifted divisor problem. And for example, Ingham proved the following asymptotic formula of sum over the n less than m of tau of n times tau of n plus h is equivalent to some constant depending on h times n log square n. And so, for example, to see that something is happening because h is not equal to zero, is when you average the square of the divisor function, you get an estimate in n times a polynomial of degree 3 in log n. A little later, Esterman, using Clostermann's non-trivial bound for the so-called Clostermann sums, made this asymptotic a little bit more precise, and he proved that indeed this is equal to degree 2 polynomial in log n times n plus an error term which is a power of n strictly less than 1. So when Weilbaum became available, then you can improve dramatically this exponent, and in fact you get much better error terms by using the theory of automorphic forms, essentially by viewing the divisor function as Fourier coefficient of modular form. And this was done in several works by Motohashi, Utilat, Tatakjan, and Vinogradov, and other people. So, but here we are most interested in the case where G is a cusp form. So this problem, it looks a bit technical, but he has some applications. So the main one is the so-called subconvexity problem. Given an automorphic L function, which we can write either as an Euler factor or as a Dirichlet series, we complete it by a factor at infinity, which is a product of gamma factors. And this product satisfies a functional equation of the type lambda pi of s is related to lambda of the contragradient of pi at 1 minus s. And there is a proportionality constant, which is called the epsilon factor, and which is the product of a number of modulus 1 times a monomial in an integer, which is a conductor. So for example, Ivanek and Cernak, for the purpose of generalizing several things, introduced the following analytic conductor of this L function, which takes care of the contribution at the finite places by the conductor, and the contribution at the infinite place, which is given by the product over the parameters at infinity of your automorphic form. So this is the analytic conductor. And so the subconvexity problem is addresses the question of the size of your automorphic L function when S is on the critical line. So unconditionally, one can prove, using in fact the theory of L function and of pairs and some additional tricks of Ivanek, that on the critical line, your L function is bounded by the analytic conductor essentially to the exponent 1/4. Of course, the generalized Riemann hypothesis says that one should replace the 1/4 by zero, but so the subconvexity problem S little cp is asked simply to improve non-trivially over the exponent 1/4. So, and in fact, this problem is in some sense very natural because it has many striking applications of various nature. So if you have seen Cernak's lectures last April, then I'm sure you are convinced of the importance of this problem. So, what is the connection with the shifted convolution problem? So, by now, many cases of the subconvexity problem are solved for GL1, GL2, and GL2 times GL2 L function. And so, in some cases, you have ad hoc method which allow you to solve the subconvexity problem, and in other cases, you don't have ad hoc methods. But in fact, all these cases can be reduced in a way of another to an instance of the shifted convolution problem. Okay, so now we discuss the various methods for solving the shifted convolution problem. And the first one is the delta symbol method, so which was used by Duke, Friedlander, Ivanek. So we recall we want to evaluate this shifted convolution sum with H not equal to zero. And the main problem is to digest the vanishing condition, the linear relation L1M minus L2N equals H. So a way to digest smoothly this condition, for example, would be to use additive characters so that the indicative function of the integers which are divisible by some integer C can be expressed in terms of additive characters, and as long as the integer you are interested in is strictly less than C, then it coincides with the Dirac function at zero. So we have such a good expression. The problem here is that we have this constraint that the variable you are interested in has to be smaller than, so more precisely, the modulus of the additive character have to be larger than the size of the variable you are interested in. So, and in fact, for application, this is a huge constraint, and you cannot do much with this. In fact, using the fact that the symmetry in the set of divisors of an integer, Ivanek has given another expression of the Dirac function as zero in terms of additive characters which have much smaller moduli, that is essentially smaller than square root of the variable. And so the symmetry is simply that if you have some divisor of n, then n over c also divides n, and either of the two divisors has to be smaller than the square root. So to implement this idea, so one takes a smooth, even compactly supported function, say, in some interval of length r, localized around r, for r some parameter, which is zero at zero, of course, and which is normalized by this condition. Then, using the symmetry of the set of divisors, the Dirac symbol at zero is expressed by this kind of sum. Now, one detects the condition that d divides n in terms of additive characters, and by chasing denominators, one gets this kind of expression where delta C of n is a smooth function and R n of C is a sum of characters, and in fact is a Ramanujan sum. And in that case, one sees that in fact when n is smaller than the square of the variable big R, one has a good representation of the Dirac distribution. So Duke, Friedlander, and Ivanek have used the delta symbol method to solve the shifted convolution problem. The method being that they start with the shifted convolution sum, digest the condition, the linear relation by means of this delta symbol. So you get additive character Cummings, and then the sum over m. So essentially, so the variable m and n are free with each other, are independent essentially, because here this sum is smooth, so it is easy to make variable here independent by a Fourier transform or things like this. And essentially, you get a product of Ecker eigenvalue twisted by additive characters. Then you can transform these two sums over m and n by applying a Voronoi type summation formula, which has this expression here, so which relates this kind of sums to similar sums where the argument is basically you take the inverse of the original argument. Here I have given the simplest form of Voronoi summation formula, namely when the modulus C is divisible by the level of the form. And the form is cuspidal here, and holomorphic of weight k. So if g has level 1, so this condition that d divides c is void, you can apply this formula to each the m and n variable in the shifted convolution sum to get a sum of this type, so sum over m and n of the lambda g of m, lambda g of n, where here you have instead of a Ramanujan sum, you have a Clostermann sum. And in fact, by this Voronoi formula, it turns out that the variable m and n are essentially constants. So then you have no other choice than to apply the Weil bound for Clostermann sum, And in fact, this is sufficient to solve the shifted convolution problem. And you have to do some analysis of the Bessel transform of V, but so this can be done. And in fact, I should remark that if you want to simply to solve the shifted convolution problem, any non-trivial bound for the Clostermann sum is sufficient to get a solution, but a weaker, of course. But what I want to say is that this method is fairly robust. Okay, so what are the applications of the shifted convolution problem? So this is the subconvexity problem. So by means of the method of moments and the amplification technique, Duke, Friedlander, Ivaniec reduce several cases of the subconvexity problem to the shifted convolution problem. And so this way, they prove that if you take a form, any form, holomorphic or not, Eisenstein or not, of level one, then the twisted L function by some character satisfies the subconvexity bound, and the Rankine-Selberg convolution by some other holomorphic cusp form satisfies the convexity bound when either the character or the form have a large level compared with G. So in particular, when you take G to be the standard derivative of the Eisenstein series, what one gets, the Rankine-Selberg L function is simply the square of the principal L function of F, and this solves the subconvexity problem for principal L function, the level aspect. So the limitation to the level one case is something purely technical. It's about the Voronoi summation formula that we have given not in the greatest generality. So in fact, it is possible to work out a more general version of this summation formula, which are messy. And immediately, what you get is an extension of this result from fixed form of level one to fixed form of any level. And so it was done by in work with Kowalski and van der Kam. And also, so there is something, yes, so there is, you can solve the subconvexity problem in this case, so for Rankine-Selberg or for twist, as long as the Nebentipus of the varying form is not too large, so is essentially smaller than the square root of the level of the form. So in particular, in this case, you cannot allow a primitive Nebentipus. Okay, so the problem with the delta symbol is that, in some sense, so in this expression here, the C range over all the integers, and in fact, it would be easier for us simply to use the simplest form of Voronoi to allow the C to be divisible by L1, L2, and the level of the form. So this is made possible by a variant of the delta symbol method due to Utila. In fact, he has shown, so I will not describe too much the method, so there is a slide on this, but he has shown that, in fact, you can have an expression of the Dirac distribution of n in terms of additive in terms essentially of Ramanujan sums of moduli, which you can choose at will as soon as the set of moduli are sufficiently dense. So in particular, you can impose the moduli to be divisible by L1, L2, and D. And so this variant, for example, was used by Arcos to provide a simplified proof of the shifted convolution problem in the twisted case, and it works also for Rankine-Selberg things. And so for the moment, this seems to be purely a technical question of simplification, but we will see later that it has some other interesting applications to know that we can do this. Okay, so there is another method which is maybe better or more conceptual, which was suggested by Selberg, and which used the spectral theory of automorphic forms. So basically, one uses this identity, but in another direction, by seeing this to be the integration, so to be the integration in a fundamental domain of the modular of the of upper half plane when you integrate over an horizontal segment of length 1. And so the method of Selberg is simply to form the gamma note of DL1 N2 invariant function of, on the upper half plane, which is essentially the product of G times G, and to integrate this against a non-holomorphic Poincaré series. So when you apply the unfolding method, what you get is that this scalar product equals some factor times a Dirichlet series, which contains the linear relation L1M minus L2M minus H equals 0. And so in this form, this approach to the shifted convolution problem is very close to what you want to do when you deal to the case H equals 0, because you deduce the case H equals 0 from the analytic property of Rankine-Selberger function. So here you have an integral representation for the shifted convolution sums. So this goes back to Selberg. And so it is easy to see that this series is absolutely converging for real part of S equals 1. And in fact, the shifted convolution sums, when G is holomorphic at least, can be expressed in terms of the function, the Dirichlet series D of S. So it is clear that if you have analytic continuation of this function behind the edge line real part of S equal 1, and you have good bounds for this Dirichlet series inside this extended domain, you will get something non-trivial and get a solution of the shifted convolution problem. So this is the following theorem of Sarnak, who has shown that this Dirichlet series can be extended analytically to real part of S strictly bigger than 1/2 plus theta, and in this range satisfying this kind of bound, which is non-trivial. And what is theta? Theta is an approximation to the Ramanujan-Peterson conjecture for GL2 mass form of weight 0. So now, by Kim Shaidi and Kim Sarnak, theta equals 7 over 64 is admissible. But in fact, just like in the case of Clostermann-Sum, any theta strictly less than 1/2 is sufficient to solve the shifted convolution problem. So the method is... what is F? Well, if G is holomorphic. Yes. So if G is not, you have something else. But okay, so... So what I say is that this result retrieves the former subconvexity bound with much better exponents thanks to the works of Kim and Shaidi. So the fact that you have a very good approximation to Ramanujan-Peterson. And so for example, Sarnak proved new cases of subconvexity which are subconvexity for Rankine-Selberger function in the weight or in the eigenvalue aspect, as we say. So maybe this is accessible to the delta symbol, I think. So the advantage is that the quality of the result you will get is linked with Ramanujan-Peterson conjecture directly. And in fact, if you pick the Gelbart-Jacquet bound or the Selberg bound, which is theta equal 1/4, you get back the results that you have with Weyl's bound for Clostermann sum. And this is not a coincidence. The proof by Selberg that theta equal 1/4 is admissible use bound for Clostermann sums. In fact, we will see that both methods can be unified. So the method is purely automorphic, smooth, and can be generalized to number fields. And so far, the delta 7 method does not seem to extend. And so for this, you have case of subconvexity in works of Petridis, Sarnak, and Cobdell, Piatetsky, Shapiro, and Sarnak. And even over Q, with an extra ingredient, this method enable to solve a case of subconvexity which is not accessible to the delta symbol. But there is one drawback. It is the case, as Ram pointed out, when G is a mass form. In that case, you still have the shifted Dirichlet series, D of S, and this time, this factor here is replaced by this factor where you have an hypergeometric function. So, apparently, so far this is not a problem. The problem comes when you want to try to relate the original shifted convolution sum to the Dirichlet series. And in this case, one does not understand completely which move function V of Mn can be represented using Mellin transform of this kind of expression. So this is possible when H is very small, but not, for example, in other cases. Okay, so eventually, Gergely-Arcos made some progress to address this question, but so far this is not solved. Okay, so, how many time? When did I start? Because. Okay. So it is important for the rest of the talk that I recall the proof of Sarnak's theorem. So, we have seen that the Dirichlet function is essentially a scalar product of the product of the two forms of G and G times a non-holomorphic Poincaré series. So you can at least formally expand spectrally your Poincaré series, expand spectrally this form, and then use Plancherel to get this spectral decomposition of this scalar product, where phi of G range over an orthonormal basis of mass form for gamma naught of D L1, L2. So, integrating against the Poincaré series gives you the Fourier coefficient of your mass form. So, essentially, you get the gamma the factor at infinity of your mass form times the Fourier coefficient. So since the local factor at infinity is holomorphic up to real part of S bigger than 1/2 plus theta, this gives you an hint of why the Dirichlet series has analytic continuation up to this half plane. And now to bound the Fourier coefficient of mass form, then you can use, so you have to make some technical things, but you can use the approximation to Ramanujan-Peterson. In fact, rho g, if your mass form is a Ecke eigenform, the Fourier coefficient is the Fourier at H is the Fourier coefficient at 1, times some fixed factor times the Ecke eigenvalue. And so, in fact, the Fourier coefficient at 1 is rather large. It is an exponential in the in the spectral parameter of the mass form. So, in order to conclude from, we have bounded this part. So we'll need to give a bound for this part, and this will give an upper bound for D. And so the problem to be able to use this method is precisely to have a bound for the triple product, which is here, which has an exponential decay, which has exactly the exponential decay to compensate the exponential growth of rho g of 1. And at this stage, so the h has completely disappeared. So and so what you need is a bound of this form where Tg is a space. So an exponential decay times a polynomial in the spectral parameter and so some constant. And this way you conclude the proof of Sarnak's theorem. So a case of the shifted convolution problem that we have not discussed so far is the case where the varying form has a Nebentipus with large conductor. So say, imagine the Nebentipus is primitive. So this problem cannot be addressed by the method of, by the delta symbol method. And in that case, so the first result is a result of Duke, Friedlander, Ivaniec for principal L function, which is extremely difficult. And so they solve the subconvexity problem for a primitive form, of a primitive cusp form with primitive Nebentipus. And here the subconvexity exponent delta is very small, 1/24. Or something like this. Yes. But still, the problem is solved. And the proof uses a very difficult variant of the shifted convolution problem that maybe we will discuss a bit later. However, using the spectral method, one can solve another case of the shifted convolution problem for Rankine-Selberger function. So I fix a primitive holomorphic form G, and I take F to be any primitive cusp form with non-trivial Nebentipus. So in particular, it could be primitive, but it's not necessary. Then the subconvexity problem is solved for this Rankine-Selberger L function.
This
is completely smooth. Okay, so I will sketch not the proof of this result, which is too hard, but the proof of this one, which is simpler, so or more conceptual. And so, okay, we denote by chi the Nebentipus. So, in fact, this shifted convolution problem can be reduced by amplification and methods of moment to this instance of the shifted convolution problem. We need to average over the H, the Gauss sum at H of the character times the shifted convolution sum. And essentially, what the bound, what, so M and N are about Q, so H is also about of size Q, and so the bound, one need a bound which is as good as the average bound that we have if you replace the Gauss sum by 1. So in some sense, if you replace the Gauss sum by 1, the trivial bound is M squared. And what we ask is to improve by m squared by some positive exponent this trivial bound. But this time the problem is that the Gauss sum, when q is primitive, is very large. It's of size square root of q. So in some sense, you have to find an extra cancellation to beat this the extra size of the Clostermann sum. Okay, in fact, even if you assume The best that you can expect for the shifted convolution sum, which is a square root cancellation, so that is that this sum should be bounded by square root of m, you still see that this does not solve this instance of the shifted convolution problem. So this means that what you have to do is to take into account the oscillation, the variation of signs of the Gauss sums. So we factor the Gauss sum accordingly, and we have a character out, a character at h, and now we can apply the spectral method to express this average into the average of over the Gauss sum of the d function that we met before. When you expand the d function spectrally, and when you reverse the summation, what you find is that the resolution of this problem amounts to proving this bound for the twisted partial sum of the Ecke eigenvalue of the mass, the weight zero mass form times the character. And m is of size q, so in fact this thing is an instance of the subconvexity problem, namely for twist by character. And this was proved before by the delta symbol method, and you get the result. Okay, so in this last result, there was a limitation that G had to be holomorphic because of the problem with the unresolved technical problem with the spectral method. Okay, so in fact, so there is a problem to solve when G is a mass form. There is a problem to solve this problem by using the spectral method, and on the other hand, the delta type symbol method are unable apparently to solve the problem. So in fact, it is possible to combine both methods to get the result we want. So what do we do? We start as before, so we take our shifted convolution sum, and we use a Jutilas variant of the delta symbol to express this, so by the usual transformation and Voronoi, as a sum of Clostermann sums of a modulus congruent to D L1, L2. Then this sum of Clostermann sums can be transformed by a Kuznetsov type formula into a sum of into a spectral sum over a basis of essentially a basis of modular form for gamma naught of q. So you get an expression, you get that this thing is expressed in terms of Fourier coefficient of the basis when you have to take the mass forms and the Eisenstein spectrum and the discrete series spectrum. And then, now we have the spectral expression of these sums, then we are back to the former method, and we can then reduce the shifted convolution problem to the shifted convolution problem for twist for mass form and twist for holomorphic forms and Dirichlet series Dirichlet L functions. And so this is work in progress with Gergely-Arkos. But we think, so this way we will prove that one can solve the shifted the subconvexity problem for when the varying form has any non-trivial Nebentipus, and G can be a mass form as well. So in particular, one can take G to be the standard Eisenstein series, and in this way. We would extend the DFE theorem for principal F function to all cases, so to all cases where F has non-trivial Nebentipus simple and not necessarily primitive. So in fact, both methods are very closely related. Okay. So now I want to discuss another
problem, which is the question of the shifted convolution. So far, G was fixed in our problems, and what we want to consider is to let the parameter G to be large with respect to the main parameters of the shifted convolution sum, say M and N. So for example, we consider only the case of the level because this is my hobby, and I want to point out that there are already some examples where this kind of uniform shifted convolution problem are solved. So the first example is that of Duke, Friedlander, Ivanek. You take a primitive character of modulus D. You take n1, n2 equal square root of D. You take a compactly supported function in some cube, in some, yes, four-dimensional cube. And then you form this kind of shifted sum. So there should be an h here. So m1, n2 minus n1, n2 equals h. And so what Duke, Friedlander, Ivanek have proved is that this sum equals a main term which depends on h times a non-trivial error term. And, okay, so how it is related to the shifted convolution problem? So, in fact, this can be seen as a kind of truncated version of the shifted convolution problem when you take you form G to be the Eisenstein series whose Fourier coefficient are the convolution of one with the character chi. So this Eisenstein series has level D, Nebentipus chi, and so we see that here we are summing the variable m1, n2, and m1, n2. They can be as large as the level of the form G. So you take G for this Eisenstein series, it has level D, and here you have a summation where this product is of size D, and this product is of size D. So this is really a uniform shifted convolution problem. And this fact, this result, is a smooth model for the resolution of this very difficult theorem. And in fact, this thing is also very difficult and very tricky. And in fact, the result is much more general because you do not need to have this function to be characters. You can put any function that you want, any wild function, say bounded by one, you get a main term plus a non-trivial error term. So, there is a second example, bizarre, which comes from the Gros-Zaguier type formula, which we found with Dinacar. So we take Q and D to be prime, and such that Q is inert in the quadratic field of discriminant minus D. And in this case, you have this expression, which is the sum over, so you pick a character of the ideal class group, which I wrote chi, and so chi equals eta here. And so this quantity are the Fourier coefficient of a modular form of weight 1. And for chi equals chi 0, you get an Eisenstein series of weight 1, and both are of level D. And then you form this shifted convolution sum. So essentially, when you have your theta series and your Eisenstein series. And here the variable n can be as large as the modulus of your two modular forms. Then you have an exact expression of this thing with a main term, which unfortunately I do not remember. So it is explicit, but I lost the paper, and so I did not want to write a mistake, plus a sum of Rankine-Selberg L functions. over a Frankenfeld-Berg function of G chi, and where F ranges over weight two holomorphic forms of level Q. So you have this sum and you have the main term. So I think, if I remember well, the main term contains square root of D times the class number. And so now you apply. So now for these things, we know we have just seen the proof of the subconvexity problem for these L functions. So this is something in D to the 1/2 minus delta. So this sum in terms of D is of size D1 minus delta. So you obtain this kind of expression, and this solves this shifted convolution problem. And in fact, so here you have the class number times square root of D. So you see that you have an asymptotic expression of the class number times square root of D by this shifted convolution sum when you take chi equals chi naught. And unfortunately, it is useless for. So it's it so far. Yes. Yes. But okay. So it's nice to. Okay. So we have seen at least two examples. So now. So I think the most powerful method to address the uniform shifted convolution problem is to consider the spectral method, which is more conceptual, and in some sense when you see better when what are the respective size of the variable. So I stick to the case where G is holomorphic so far, and so I take G an holomorphic cusp form. And so, say the objective would be to solve new case of the shifted convolution problem for these Rankine-Selberg convolutions, where F and G can both have large levels. So, to simplify the discussion, I will suppose that that the level of F and G are primes, and that the Nebentipus are trivial. So then, basically, you have two cases. The case when the two primes are equal, and in this case, the conductor of this so in both cases, the conductor of the Rankine-Selberg L function is the square of the LCM of Q and D. So it is either Q equals Q square or it equals QD. So when you apply the amplification method to solve the subconvexity problem for this Rankine-Selberg L function, essentially you are reduced to solve this shifted convolution problem. So you have this shifted convolution sum, and because the Nebentipus are trivial, your Gauss sum gets replaced by your Ramanujan sum. So essentially you have two cases, because if H does not essentially divide this thing, then you get that your Ramanujan sum is essentially constant, is essentially 1. But if H is divisible by this quantity, then the Ramanujan sum makes a bump, and you have a main contribution, which is of size QD. So either you have no averaging over H and the factor QD, or you have an averaging over H coprime with QD, but this averaging is of length QD. So in some sense, so you have two cases to consider, and no case is better than the other. In some sense. So we will see that one case is worse than the other. And we want to solve this problem where L1, L2 are extremely small. So. Okay, so then we can go to the spectral method. And remember that the spectral expansion of this you have the spectral expansion of the product of your form G times G by the non holomorphic Poincaré series. You expand it spectrally, and basically you have to bound the Fourier coefficient, and you have to have good bound for the triple product. So the main thing is the main point where one wants to get things is from the problem of uniformity of bounds for the triple product. Yes. Okay. So now maybe comes the question of how one can obtain the exponential decay of this triple product. So Sarnak's method used, I think, the spherical model of G and phi G, and a kind of deformation argument to establish this result. And so you can make some bookkeeping of the various constants involved, and what you get is that on average over a basis which is bounded up to, whose spectral parameters are bounded up to size t, you get a bound of this type with d to the exponent 5 over 2. So there are other methods for obtaining this. One is a method invented by Bernstein and Reznikov, which built on the technique of analytic continuation of representation on a real Lie group. So in fact, in that case, it was SL2 of R. And this method was generalized by Crotz and Stanton, in particular to include the case where G was a discrete series, which was not treated originally by Bernstein and Reznikov. So you can, again, for these two methods, you can make some bookkeeping of the parameters of the various forms, and there is a simple argument of Kowalski, which is not at all arithmetic. It works for any lattice, not necessarily a congruence group, and which gives you this better exponent of d over 3 over 2 for this average. And you see also that this method gives a better exponent in the t aspect. Okay, but so these methods do not exploit essentially the fact that you have an action of the finite part of the Ecker algebra, and so in some sense they do not exploit the arithmetic structure of the situation that you have a congruence group, and in fact one can think of another method. So for the moment, I assume that L1, L2 equal 1, and that phi g is a primitive form. Then you have formulas by Kudla, Harris, Gross-Kudla, Böschrer, Schulze-Pilsow, and Watson, which relate the triple products to central value of triple products L function, so the triple product L of g times z times your mass form. And more precisely, the relation, so which in this case of interest is due to Watson, is that the square of the triple product divided by the square of the L2 norm of G equals this expression. In particular, from the expression of the gamma factors of the triple product L function and the symmetric squares L function, you get quickly the exponential decay in the TG parameter. So this is in some sense another much more complicated proof of the exponential decay. And okay, so but one wants more. So basically we are interested in the D aspect here. So in fact, the triple product and function in that case, and this is important, splits into the product. So F is phi g into the product of the sim square of the GL3 times GL2 times a GL2 L function. And the conductor of these L function are D4 and D. So it means that so a possibility to get a bound would be to apply the convexity bound for these L functions, which are known. But this is not quite enough. In fact, you do not get with applying directly the convexity bound, you do not get the free half. You get 2, I think, something like this. So you do not. So the convexity bound would be d to the 5 over 4. So instead, you use the fact that the sum you are interested in is an average over a basis. So, and the basis is a form of level essentially d. So you have a really big averaging here. So you proceed on average. The thing you do this is you can represent this L function as essentially a partial sum of length d square, and this one as a partial sum of length d to the 1/2, and you want to consider this average of these partial sums. So you have sum over g over, you have, so the thing you are interested in is bounded by this kind of sum. You have some funny parameter over n to the 1/2, and n is up to d square. And here you have the same thing, n to the 1/2, and n goes to d to the 1/2. And what you do is you use Cauchy-Schwarz and you apply a large sieve inequality. And then what you get from this is a bound with this exponent 5 over 4, which is better than the 3 over 2. Okay, so I have put this as a conjecture, which is proven when L1, L2 equals to 1, but so far there is no very nice formula in. So even if L1, L2 are very small with respect to the variable, so far there is no nice formula relating this thing to this thing. So in fact, what I expect is that this triple product is related to the central value of this triple product for the corresponding new vectors up to factors, which up to local factors, which are localized at L1, L2, and which are bounded polynomially in L1, L2. So that's why I take this conjecture in the general case for L1, L2 of a bound of this type of L1, L2 to the 100,000 with the d over 3/4. So this is maybe not a conjecture, maybe this is a question of, so the status is maybe too important. And in fact, recently there was a new technique of Bernstein-Reznikov using, you see that to get this exponent, it is extremely important that you have this splitting. So, which means that you have g and g. If you have two different forms, and in the generic case you have no splitting, you have a cuspid L function, then you cannot apply Cauchy-Schwarz and you don't get a good result. So the splitting is important. In fact, this splitting is important in a new technique of Bernstein that Bernstein and Reznikov have developed to prove the exponential decay, which is built on technique on invariant trilinear and bilinear forms. And their method seemed to suggest that the exponent 9 over 8 is admissible. But in fact, this exponent is sufficient for us. Then, using this bound and several cases of subconvexity in lower dimension, in lower degree, one can prove the following. So this is joint work with Henrik. So I state the basic theorem, which is rough, and so you can have something more subtle if you allow the level to be square free instead of being primes. So you measure the size of one conductor with respect to the other by this parameter eta, then unconditionally, if eta is smaller than this quantity, so 1/2 minus theta over 1/2 plus theta, then you can solve the subconvexity problem for this L function. Moreover, if you assume question or conjecture 1, then you can replace this ratio by 1/2 minus theta over 1/4 plus theta, which is smaller. Then you solve the problem. So when you take theta equal the admissible 7 over 64, then you get here that this ratio, of course, this ratio has always to be smaller than 1. So, but you get 25 over 39, so which is not that far from 1. But when you use conjecture 1, you get the ratio 25 over 23, which is strictly bigger than 1, which means that you may flip if you want F and G. And so it means that under this conjecture, you solve the you solve the subconvexity problem where the levels are prime and distinct, whatever the levels are. Okay, so there remains one problem, which is when the levels are equal. And in fact, when the levels are equal, so there is something different. In fact, at this point, the Eisenstein spectrum enters the picture. In fact, the problem comes from the Eisenstein theory at the cusp zero, and the Fourier coefficient is not small. And in that case, the triple product, so phi g equals this quantity, essentially equals the symmetric square of your fixed form g. And in fact, then you are blocked. So everything goes well under this conjecture for the cuspidal spectrum. And for the Eisenstein spectrum, you get essentially something like, you get that you have to solve the subconvexity problem for the symmetric square. So in this case, one has the following theorem. If J is holomorphic of prime level, and suppose you can solve the convexity problem for the symmetric square in the level aspect, then for any primitive form of the same level Q with trivial Neventipus, you can solve the subconvexity problem for LF times G. So in some sense, one L function gives you all the other. In fact, the thing is that we are going to a kind of circle, because why we investigated this problem with the objective of solving the subconvexity problem for the symmetric square. Because the way we wanted to do this is to solve the subconvexity problem for the Rankine-Selberg of L of G times G by solving it among all the L of F times G. So using a method of family which contains this one. And so we see that. Okay, so thank you very much.